they were cleaning up after capitalism.
So you just showed me a headline about what we're allowed to carry here in Milwaukee in the security zone, what we can't carry and what we can.
Yes, there's been a real fight in Milwaukee. It's been a very interesting issue. Now, in the convention hall, you can't have a gun unless you're a police officer or Secret Service, something like that. But in the area around it, in what is considered to be what they call the soft zone, and that's a zone where they have a lot of security, a lot of oversight, and it's right around the convention, this city has done, at the request of security folks, and that they've banned tennis balls, hard water bottles, tents.
So I can't bring a water bottle.
Not a hard water bottle. Not the kind that, you know, like you drink
out. That you can outside. Throw.
Yeah. And the list is really long. Tape has banned because, you know, tape above longer than 6 inches, things like that. All sorts of stuff banned. Not guns. In fact, very serious guns.
You can bring a gun.
You can bring a gun. Yes, guns are not banned. And that is because the state of Wisconsin has preempted cities from banning guns. And all sorts of guns. And so there's been an ongoing battle here in the city of Milwaukee where the city council has literally said, because there's a lot of residents in downtown. Downtown is a very developed downtown, a lot of apartments, a lot of condominiums. They've said, look, can't we have an exemption here? Can't we say, you know, let's keep guns out of this area? No, don't be openly carrying guns, stuff like that. And they have basically been told you can't do that. And so it's been a huge battle in this city. And the governor, just after this horrible incident in Butler, Pennsylvania, Governor Tony Evers of Wisconsin, over the weekend, re-upped and said, can't we do something to have tougher restrictions on guns? Again, not in the convention hall, but in the area around it, for all sorts of good reasons. And as it was said in one of the news reports just this morning, doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere to actually do that ban.
So no tennis balls, no hard water bottles, but you can carry guns.
Yeah.
Which takes us into our next segment. John, I want to thank you so much for being with us. John Nichols is the nation's national affairs correspondent. We're going to link to his new piece headlined Americans Know Political Violence All Too Well. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including his latest, co-written with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, titled It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Milwaukee, from the Republican National Convention. Saturday's shooting of Donald Trump is being widely viewed as the Secret Service's biggest failure since 1981. When a gunman shot President Ronald Reagan just over 2 months after Reagan's presidency began. Reagan was hospitalized for nearly 2 weeks. Three other people were injured, including Reagan's press secretary, James Brady, who was shot in the head and left partially paralyzed. Brady and his wife, Sarah, would go on to become prominent gun control advocates, pushing for a bill that became known as the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act. Brady was also involved in a gun control organization that changed its name to the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. It's now known simply as Brady. To talk more about Saturday's shooting at the Trump rally, the attempted assassination of the former president and the current presidential candidate, Trump, we're going to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Chris Brown, the president of Brady. Chris, first, your response to what happened on Saturday. You have this young 20-year-old with some AR-15-type rifle climbing this building and opening fire on the Trump rally, grazing the former president over his right ear, ultimately killing a spectator. Two are critically wounded. He was immediately shot dead by Secret Service. Chris, your response?
Well, like John, and I'm sure Americans across this country, my reaction is one of horror. Even though, to be honest, Amy, we know that gun violence is omnipresent, we do expect higher scrutiny and security apparatus to ensure the safety of our candidates. but it's not perfect. And in a nation awash in firearms, that are assault-style weapons, which the reports indicate was the kind of weapon that this shooter used, designed for the battlefield, it's not a stretch to understand that there is that kind of potential risk that exists. And it's a horrific element of American life that we, as Brady, want to ensure is no longer the reality. And they're very simple, common sense things that we can do to reduce and indeed virtually eliminate this kind of risk from American life. And politicians seeking office have very different perspectives about that very thing, as you covered even in the focus on the kinds of weapons that you can carry around the convention. You can't carry a water bottle, but you can carry a firearm. There's a deep inconsistency here in American life that needs to be tackled, just as Jim and Sarah Brady devoted their lives to common sense gun laws. There's a lot more work we have to do here.
So, I mean, you just heard John Nichols describe the rules here in Milwaukee,
yeah.
Right outside the convention center. Hard water
yeah.
bottles, no. Tennis balls, no. Guns, yes. And even when the governor attempted to modify this, the state said no.
Yeah. Well, that's an increasing trend across the country. And I will note, certainly, my thoughts and prayers go to former President Donald Trump, associated with this horrific shooting. The reality when he was president is he tried to make what's called concealed carry reciprocity, lots of fancy words, for a basic premise that every single kind of local law about who could be permitted to carry a gun in public would have been overturned. So the idea of local rule to protect the safety of citizens by local politicians, that would have been completely upended. And let's just be very clear. When Trump was president, a major focus of his presidency, largely thwarted by organizations like Brady, was guns everywhere for anyone at any time. We know an America awash in guns, an America where individuals are carrying firearms in public places, means that it's much more likely that those firearms are used in the subjective view of an individual to protect themselves. But the criteria for when and how that happens is up to the individual. And so we will see in that kind of America much more violence, much more actions just like this. And that's what's deeply concerning to people like me, Americans across this country with children and hopefully grandchildren living in a world where reasonable and appropriate gun violence prevention measures save lives. And too often we're going on the brink of stopping that America from happening, creating a much more dangerous, highly charged, politically fraught environment in which to attempt to advance democracy. And democracy and gun violence don't fit together. As you have noted, we've lost presidents. Obviously, it's not just that, Amy. It's also the people who stand by and come in a democracy to participate in it. That is the quintessence of democracy. Someone like Jim Brady, who serves a president. So it's not just the individual, the candidate, who is the target of these kinds of attacks. It's all of the innocent bystanders who are effectively essential to a participatory democracy. And we have to internalize that as well.
So, Chris, you know, I don't know how many people realize that the press room that we watch at the White House is actually called the James S. Brady Press Briefing Room, where all of the journalists at the White House question President Biden, his press secretary, et cetera. Can you talk about the radically different approaches to guns of President Biden and President Trump? What are their policies? What was Trump's when he was president? What has Biden called for in the past? What has he been prevented from doing now? I mean, essentially, isn't he one of the people for the weapons ban that was in place in the Senate for so many years?
So much, Amy, and it's hard to encapsulate in a few minutes, but the easiest way to synthesize this is it's night and day, literally. One of the top priorities for former President Trump was to overturn a lot of the most basic gun violence prevention laws that had been in effect for years and years and years. So when he first assumed the role of president after being sworn in, through an arcane law called the Congressional Review Act, he overturned an Obama rule that would have ensured a process to remove firearms temporarily from veterans who were at risk of harming themselves or others. That was his top priority, and he used a tool that had almost never been used in history to overturn that rule that had been the subject of review and discussion and public comment in support of the rule for years before it was finalized. He went on then to introduce two different pieces of legislation, neither of which ultimately passed because groups like ours opposed it. So much information came out. The first was concealed carry reciprocity, which is a very fancy way to say permitting systems across this country adopted by state and local governments, people like Tony Evers saying, this is the kind of permitting system that we want to have heightened scrutiny about who gets to carry guns in public. Is the person at risk or not? And we get to deny it. There was legislation to overturn all of these laws across the country. We successfully pushed that back. And then another bill dubbed the Hearing Protection Act, but that would have basically switched how the sale of silencers occurs across this country, which are subject to heightened scrutiny under the 1934 Firearms Act. It would have removed those protection and allowed the sale of firearms basically in your Costco or in your Walmart or other major vendors where firearms are sold. And let's be clear, the purpose of silencers from the 1934 time forward was to mute the sound of gunfire, making it much harder for police to respond instantly to these kinds of horrific shootings. So that's the stark reality of President Trump and his focus, fueled by one of his greatest investors for his campaign, contributing more than any other nonprofit, the National Rifle Association. Let's contrast that to President Biden. From day one on the campaign trail, and this is consistent with his 40-year history as a public servant, he has said reduction of gun violence in America, the number one killer of our kids, is a top priority. And from day one, he has done everything he can to make that happen. He's responsible for passage of the most bipartisan legislation in the history of the gun violence prevention movement, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. More than 15 Republicans, including John Cornyn from Texas, who was a chief co-sponsor of that legislation, passed. It called for expanded background checks across the country. Incredible, unprecedented funding for community violence intervention. These programs are shown to work to reduce things like homicide. And by the way, under President Biden, we have had record reductions in homicide in cities across this country. He offered a rule on ghost guns. He has authorized many more inspections of gun dealers across this country. And, Amy, we have more gun dealers than Starbucks and McDonald's combined. And this president understands it's not just about policy. Policy is important. But unless you enforce that policy well, you will never have a true reduction in gun violence. So he has someone at ATF, leading ATF, Steve Dettelbeck, who is laser focused on giving gun dealers, giving the ATF the tools to inspect gun dealers and shut down the few of them, relatively, that are responsible for a huge amount of crime guns that are flooding the market across the country. And he established the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, led by two survivors of gun violence. They fight night and day to have a whole-of-government approach to address this issue. The Surgeon General has issued a report on gun violence as a public health epidemic. I could go on and on and on. And none of these actions are inconsistent with a reasonable view of the Second Amendment, Amy, and I think that's really important.
Chris, just before we go, and we just have a minute, I want to read a CNN report that came out right before this weekend, the attempted assassination. This is from CNN. Vending machines selling ammunition will now be in grocery stores in Alabama, Texas, and Oklahoma, a move that's generated mixed feelings from officials in those states. American Rounds, distributor of the machines, uses AI technology to scan the customer's identification as well as facial recognition software to verify a customer's identity, according to the company. Software. Again, vending machines selling ammunition will now be in grocery stores in Alabama, Texas, and Oklahoma. Your final comment.
Well, I think this is a horrific trend and one that really the Biden administration is aware of and deeply concerned about. We think that the Department of Justice should look at this and seek action to shut this down. Look, if you're shopping in a grocery store and you're standing in line with your children, the idea that any person can come in and buy ammunition from a vending machine, where all it's checking, Amy, is, are you the person you say you are? It's not doing a background check. It's doing nothing to stop the sale of that ammunition other than to confirm you are the person you say you are. That is deeply concerning because we, as we know, have a huge problem with gun violence in this country. And dealers, gun dealers in this country today sell firearms and ammunition. Those clerks, the individuals that most quality gun dealers, and most of them are, train to stop sales if they view a person is at risk. AI is no substitute for that. This will make no
mistake.
Chris
Brown, we're going to have to leave it there.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, President of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence prevention organizations in the United States, named for Jim Brady, who was shot in the head during an attempted assassination of former President Ronald Reagan. When we come back, Israeli airstrikes kill at least 90 people in a massive attack on a designated safe zone in Gaza. Hundreds more are wounded. Back in 30 seconds. By Moondog. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Israeli warplanes and drones continue to bombard areas across the Gaza Strip, killing over 80 Palestinians in the last 24 hours. The continued assault comes in the wake of Israel's attack on Saturday on Al-Mawasi, an area in Khan Yunis designated as a safe zone that killed at least 90 Palestinians, half of them women and children, and injured over 300 in one of the deadliest attacks in Gaza in weeks. The UN and several countries condemned the bombing, which targeted thousands of displaced Palestinians crowded in tents. The Israeli military claimed without evidence that it was targeting Hamas military chief Mohammed Deif. However, Hamas denies that Deif was killed. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a televised news conference Saturday it wasn't clear whether he had been killed. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant nevertheless praised the attack, saying Hamas was losing its ability to organize, arm itself, or care for the wounded. Also on Saturday, the Israeli military struck a makeshift mosque during noon prayer in the Shati refugee camp in West Gaza City, killing at least 20 Palestinians. Then on Sunday, Israeli airstrikes on a United Nations school sheltering thousands of displaced Palestinians in the Nusayrat refugee camp killed at least 22 and injured over 100 people. Meanwhile, rescue workers say they found at least 60 bodies under the rubble of the Shijaya neighborhood of Gaza City following Israel's withdrawal from the area last week after leaving it in ruins. This weekend, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told a donors conference for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, quote, "Just when we thought it couldn't get any worse in Gaza, somehow, appallingly, civilians are being pushed into ever deeper circles of hell," he said. For more, we go to Mohammed Shahada, a writer and analyst from Gaza, chief communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, columnist for the Forward newspaper, a Jewish weekly in New York. He's joining us from Copenhagen, Denmark. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! First of all, talk about this safe zone that Israel struck on Saturday, killing 90, injuring hundreds of others.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy. Well, the first thing is that this is not the first time where they conduct such an atrocity, such a carnage, a bloodbath with immense magnitude, and then claim there was a Hamas leader there to cover it up. It was done dozens and dozens and dozens of times in Gaza. So a couple of weeks ago, Israel pounded an entire residential block in the Shati refugee camp in Gaza City and claimed that Ra'ed Sa'ed, commander of the Qassam brigades, was there. We never heard any updates about that ever since, not even a confirmation or an allegation that he was killed. So this has been done repeatedly. The way the carnage unfolded is atrocious on every single level possible. So Israel used what they call fire belts, which is almost like carpet bombing. They dropped simultaneously about five bombs, each is about 2,000 pounds, on top of what they have designated themselves as Gaza's only humanitarian safe zone, that they've been crowding hundreds of thousands of people there by force, and then bombed them to kill and wound over 400 people. So it didn't stop even there. After the carnage unfolded, as soon as ambulances and firefighters came to the area, Israel started to bomb and target those as well. They killed multiple firefighters and attacked ambulance crews to delay the rescue mission in that area. What this reminds me of is basically, if you remember in 2002, Israel assassinated Hamas's top, most wanted, most dangerous militant commander, Salah al-Shahada, the founder of the Qassam Brigades. Back then, the airstrike killed about 14 civilians. Seven of them were children. The Bush administration, George W. Bush, he came out and condemned Israel in unprecedented terms and said this is heavy-handed and this impedes and prevents peace. That was George Bush at the time. Now we are at a situation where it's so insane that Biden was not only silent, dead silent, not a word on this, but he's the one that provided all the weaponry, all the bombs that Israel very gladly obliged and rained down on that refugee humanitarian safe zone. You also had at that time, you had about 27 Israeli pilots in 2002 that it declared they will not participate anymore in reserve service in the IDF because of the human casualty, the high death toll, seven children, only seven. At this point, what you have is near unanimity in the Israeli political and defense establishment of saying this was more than justified. This was a great operation, although they cannot until now confirm or provide any evidence that Aldeyev, the commander of the Qassam Brigades, was even there. So we've got to a situation where Israel is being told you can do whatever you want, anything you want at all. That's basically the message they're getting from the Biden administration and from the European Union as well, from European member states. The only red line that Biden is implementing, and that's something that I keep hearing from sources close to the White House, is that just don't engage in a regional conflict that involves Iran and Lebanon and bugs the United States down into that war. Otherwise, carry on with whatever you want. We heard a lot of red lines about Rafah from Biden in May. And as soon as Israel went in, turned Rafah into what humanitarian workers are now calling a wasteland. Nothing is left there. Almost virtually nothing is standing. They burned, destroyed homes on their way systematically, left dozens of bodies to rot and decompose and get eaten by dogs and cats on the street. And sometimes they scoop it with bulldozers and bury it with the rubble if there's a humanitarian mission coming in. We saw unimaginable, unique, unprecedented ugliness that violate every norm, not only of international law, but of common humanity. And Biden is unwilling to put down a foot and say, you violated any of my red lines. It's the same message they're getting from Europe. So I was recently at a meeting with a top European official. He gave us his tablet, circled it around the table, and showed us satellite imagery of Gaza before and after that the EU has been gathering. And he said, look at this, what Israel is doing, they are wiping out the place. And he said, quote, their goal is to make Gaza unlivable, uninhabitable. So if the war ends, nobody can live there anymore. People have to leave. So in other words, to finish the Gaza question, take it out of the equation completely. So those European officials, they know. But the same official said that he doesn't have much to, that he's incapable of doing much because about 80% of European governments just want Israel to carry on and do whatever they want without sort of stopping them or challenging this atrocity or genocide that's unfolding. The only thing that they've been asking for, so for instance, the German foreign minister went to Tel Aviv or Israel about 8 times. The only thing she asked for was continue the killing, just kill fewer people, spread the killing across time so it does not look spectacular. Occasionally, Israel violates that and kills over 100 people, but as long as they keep it about 100 people per day. Again, I cannot imagine that this number is acceptable. 100 people per day, this is okay for European and capitals and Western governments.
Mohammed Shahada, we're here in Milwaukee covering the Republican National Convention. Can you talk about President Trump's policy when it comes to Israel? Talk about his relationship with Netanyahu. Talk about what happened during the Great March of Return, moving the embassy, etc.
Well, basically, Trump his second term is a nightmare for people in Gaza, because he's been very clear during the Biden-Trump debate, the presidential debate, that Israel wants to carry on and continue this war indefinitely, and he's willing to indulge in that, to let them finish the job, as he said. That is basically, when I talk to people in Gaza, they react with immense fear about a second Trump term. But unexpected thing for sure is that he's going to empower every fundamentalist, lunatic, extremist, right-wing hawk to put them in charge of Middle East peace, as he did during his first term. He put a messianic Israeli-American settler, David Friedman from Beit Eil, he put him as the American ambassador to Israel to take what was termed at the time the sledgehammer policy, destroy everything that would be there to enable a Palestinian state to be established, expand settlements, recognize settlements as not necessarily illegal under international law, remove the labeling of settlement products,
Mohammed, we have 10 seconds.
And defund hospitals. But the problem is that Biden administration hasn't been any better in many ways. The last 3 years have been the deadliest there is in Palestinian-Israeli relations since records began 2005.
Mohammed Shahada, I want to thank you for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, columnist for The Forward newspaper, a Jewish weekly in New York. That does it for our broadcast. We have a job opening of development director in charge of fundraising at Democracy Now! Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Milwaukee.
Interested in joining improv sessions? Four seasoned facilitators are holding an event involving climate change on July 12th between 7 and 9 p.m. All experiences